Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the Andrew Luck Book Club Podcast. And today I'm honored to be joined by a very, very special guest, the co-founder, as I learned in the book, not founder, co-founder of the greatest shoe company, greatest apparel company in the world, Nike, Mr. Phil Knight. Thanks for being on here, Mr. Knight.
Thanks very much. I thought we'd probably start with a rendition of the Sanford fight song. We'll come join the band if you'd lead off.
You're putting me on the spot. It's a book club podcast, not a singing podcast, sir. I don't think I want to turn people off. Well, since you brought up Stanford, I need to address what I think might be the elephant in the room. Obviously, I'm a Stanford undergrad. You're a Stanford Graduate School of Business graduate, but an Oregon undergrad. And as a former Stanford football player, I may not like to answer this, but I need to know, do you root for Oregon or Stanford in the football games?
Well, those are the two schools, really, that gave birth to Nike. But I competed for Oregon on the track team.
Mm-hmm.
So in athletic competition, I root for Oregon. But Stanford is one of my favorite. Obviously, it was very important to the development of Nike.
Yeah.
The original business plan was written there,
mm-hmm.
and it's been one of the main recipients of my charitable contributions to school. It's very dear to my heart, as it is, I'm sure, to you.
Absolutely. Well, I guess it's consolation prize that you root for Stanford, and when they're not playing Oregon. And I must say that the cafeteria in the Knight Business School, as it's now called, is the best cafeteria on campus. Good food there. So you got that right on the campus.
That's good to know.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So today we'd love to talk about Shoe Dog, and I should first mention that thank you for sharing the story behind the swoosh and the brand. And I told you this before we started. I know as an athlete who endorses Nike, I'm certainly even more proud, you know, to wear Nike after reading the book. And I sort of wondered, the modern day Nike, when you were 25 years old, did you envision Nike becoming this, or was it always sort of a running shoe company in your mind?
Well,
and Blue Ribbon too, obviously.
Yeah, it started out mainly as a running shoe company, and I really enjoyed what I was doing, and
mm-hmm.
I thought I was pretty good at it, and I hoped that I'd get to the point where I could make a living doing it. It obviously became much bigger than what anybody could have expected.
Yeah.
The annual athletic shoe sales in the United States, I think, were about $2 billion when I started. Nike shoe athletic shoe sales last year in the United States were about $10
billion.
So the industry got a lot bigger.
Yeah. Is it because there are more feet on the ground, or is it a bigger industry?
There are a few more feet, but it's obviously sports and fitness has become big.
No, absolutely. And not to mention
the biggest part of it.
Yeah, not to mention, I think, also the fashion side that Nike seems to get. So reading the book, I feel like I had to keep reminding myself that Nike does actually succeed, you know, that you guys actually pull through, that it's not going to fail. I mean, there it felt like four or five times with Blue Ribbon, with Nike, that you're on the precipice of losing everything, but you always seem to just...
because we were.
I guess so, but you seem to absorb it. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Well, yeah, I mean, it really was a bumpy ride, and we were right on the edge of failure many times. I know your comments were very similar to Robin Roberts on ABC News. She said,
okay,
I don't know how it ends, but I think he's not going to make it. and that really was, it was really touch and go, but... it was really great working with a band of brothers for a common cause. And we knew we might fail, and we knew we were on the edge a couple times, but we just never believed we would, and we just believed. And and it was a pleasure working together, and it was and looking back, it was actually, I enjoyed it.
That's funny to say that you enjoy it, because you certainly feel the stress that you went through through a lot of those times. And you mentioned your sort of band of brothers, and I'm – I feel like my mom's going to get mad at me for saying this word, but the butt faces.
that's what we called each other.
Yeah, it stems from you guys yelling at each other on your work retreats, right?
Right, right. And I think, obviously, there's something to the fact that, creative ideas come out of, emotional sessions, and you can't be afraid to let your feelings known, and those actually were effective for us.
A butt face is a good term in the Nike world.
It was in those days. We don't use that so much anymore.
Okay.
More like your mother now. Those are off limits now.
Yeah, that's funny. That is funny. And it seems like all you guys had a very different personalities in maybe different ways of looking at things. And my perspective in reading the book was that you felt like that created a lot of the creative force by those early days at Nike. Would you say that's true?
Exactly right. We had a lot of different perspectives and guys that really were kind of misfits.
Yeah.
But were really bright and intense. And I've said many times, I don't know if they were geniuses or near geniuses, but they had all the emotional baggage of genius. It always made it interesting.
So I have one of your last paragraphs in the book, you, page 383, you write, and you're sort of talking about this another crazy idea, and I think that the idea is the memoir, and you write, so much to do,
right,
so much to learn, so much I don't know about my own life. And I'm wondering, what did you end up learning about your own life in this process of writing a memoir, and how was that process?
Well, it took 3 years and okay, 8 drafts, and it was a lot of it that was enjoyable, looking back and taking having a perspective that I really didn't have when I was going through the times that are described in there. And it was great getting back together with Jeff Johnson and Bob Waddell,
yeah,
and reminiscing, and and I looked at it a little bit different. I there was a lot of tension at the time, but as I said, it was in every respect it was enjoyable in many ways. That you go to work every Monday morning and you knew what you did that day mattered. And
yeah,
so the adrenaline was all, it's kind of a little bit like your athletic world. Every day matters and every Saturday doubly matters.
Yeah.
So that was sort of our life, and I enjoyed it, and it was fun putting that in a different kind of perspective than just the tension that when I was going through it.
Yeah. With writing the book and going back, you write about Jeff Johnson's letters that he wrote to you sort of ad nauseum every day. Did you end up finding any of those letters?
Oh, yeah, we found some of them. They're in the archives. I mean, there were so many of them.
And did you end up responding 30, 40, 50 years later to any of those letters to him?
Well, we're really quite good friends, and it is exaggerated a little bit, but just about the time I'd want to respond to his first letter, I get a second letter. So it was hard to keep up.
And this was before email and Twitter. You couldn't just direct message him.
Right.
Couldn't direct message him. I think one of my other favorite parts of the book are when you write about Steve Prefontaine. And I must confess, I did not know who he was until I went to college. And I think you guys did a line, maybe pre-lives, with a silhouette of him running. I want to say, and I saw someone wearing the shirt and had to Google who he was, and then playing up at Oregon or down in Corvallis or Eugene. You know, you'd see a billboard of him every now and then running, and sort of read his story. But the way you write about him is almost reverent, the hero sort of aura around him. And you obviously write about how important he was to the early success of your company. Could you just talk about him a bit?
Yeah, obviously he meant the world to us at Nike, and I think to most Oregonians, and then for the entire track and field community. He was, a lot of people described him as James Dean and Spike. He not only held every American record from like 2,000 meters to 10,000 meters, but it was kind of the way he ran. He was fearless.
Yeah.
It was exciting. There really hasn't been anything quite like him since. He really created an excitement on the track that has been missing since his death.
Yeah. Yeah. And died too young, as so many great ones, you know, unfortunately seemed to happen. And you mentioned that the way he ran with his heart and sort of seemed to be on his sleeve, he really captured the imagination of and the hearts of Oregonians, right? And many fans. You've been in the sports world for a long time. Have you run across any other athletes that you think captured that spirit that he had in any sport?
Well, I mean, obviously I think there's an emotion created on the athletic field, unlike any place else. That it's just genuine and mm-hmm. it's of the moment. And so, yeah, there's been a lot of times and a lot of places. I mean, I look back and the impact on me, it goes clear back to Roger Bannister and and obviously it just doesn't happen on the track. You get it with Michael Jordan, you get it with LeBron James, you get it with Tiger Woods,
mm-hmm.
you get it with Andrew Luck.
I don't know about that, but thank you. Yeah, it's great. And the other man that you write a lot about is Coach Bowerman, and you obviously had a very strong relationship as a runner for him as your coach, him as your partner, him as a mentor. You referenced that, you know, that lunch with him, and you know, I think over a burger and shaking hands, saying deal, it working out. And have you come across any other coaches maybe that influenced kids like Coach Bowerman influenced you?
Oh, I think, that's what a coach does.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously the relationship with Bowerman was really special. And I often said, if there is no Bill Bowerman, there is no me.
Yeah.
Because without him, I'd be something entirely different. I'm not sure what it would be, but I would be talking to you right now.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, a coach is an honorary title. And, that I think the good ones all have enormous impacts on kids. My grandson is going to Jesuit High School in Portland, Oregon. He's kind of been stumbling around. He went out to football, and the football coach is mentoring him, and he's all of a sudden he's kind of on track and doing good things. And I think David Shaw is one that probably applies. And
absolutely.
You can just name a lot of them.
Absolutely. David Shaw, the great coach of the Stanford Cardinal, he was certainly a great mentor to me. And I know coaches along the way have really made my life better and challenged you, and it seems to me that Coach Bowerman did that for you, not only as a college undergrad, but as a 25-year-old, a 30-year-old, all the way through Nike.
All the way through.
That's awesome.
I think some psychologists would say, well, I started the company so that I could keep my relationship with Bowerman.
That's funny. With the swoosh in the logo, is it old hat for you now to see a LeBron James wear it, or a Tiger Woods, or a Cristiano Ronaldo, or does it still sort of give you the thrills to see the swoosh on the biggest stage in the world, whether it's an NBA Finals or a Masters or a World Cup?
It never gets old. It's still a thrill. Absolutely.
Oh, that's awesome. That's awesome. And is there a live sporting event that you've attended that you've said that takes the cake by far, with not being, you know, Steve Prefontaine's great run, I think, at Oregon? I imagine that's got to be one of the highlights, right?
Yeah, but there've been so many.
Yeah.
I'm obviously a real sports junkie, so I wouldn't trade positions with anybody, but I couldn't tell you whether Wimbledon is better than the Final Four, or the Super Bowl is better mm-hmm. than the Olympic Games. I mean, they're all great in my mind.
Yeah, that's probably the right answer. There's probably great things about each one that you probably appreciate in many, many different ways. So I asked a couple friends who also read the book if they had any questions for you, and one that was pretty consistent was, do you have a favorite shoe in your line?
Yeah, I mean, we've had the Pegasus shoe in the line for 20 years, and it's still for me the best day in, day out running shoe.
Awesome. And do you still use the Pegasus to run?
I do. Although I got passed the other day by an old lady in a baby carriage.
Oh, nice. what does that do to your psyche?
I was walking, not running.
Oh, I don't know about that. It's probably a testament that you're still out there moving around. That's pretty cool.
Well, I am doing that.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. One of the other really, I thought, neat parts of the book, when you talk about your fictitious characters, the stories you told your kids, Matt History and Travis History. Do you still use that with your grandkids, or have they grown too old? And where did that come from?
I just thought early on when Matt was 3 or 4 years mm-hmm. old, that I just thought, well, I'll teach him history lessons by making the stories exciting, and he'll go to school and he'll know history before everybody else. And it didn't really take that way, but it did create some interest. But the grandkids, it doesn't take as much because I don't get to do it every night. I've tried it a couple times, and they don't respond very good.
I thought it was pretty cool, and a really sort of neat glimpse into your guys' home life. Sort of back to the products in the shoes. Is there a shoe or product that you're most proud of that Nike has put out, or something that Nike has accomplished that you're most proud of?
No, I mean, obviously that we're about innovation.
Mm-hmm.
So when we come up with innovations, that there've been a lot of them. I mean, obviously Air was one that was the biggest.
Yeah.
We've also had the Flyknit uppers that we're using now make for really lightweight and used. It's copied almost universally. And in the football shoes, the skeletal cleats that we've got now make them lighter and faster and better. And so it's really kind of a genre that we get excited about when we come up with an innovation that can be spread across several different products.
You mentioned the Air, and I thought it was a great part of the book where you write about you guys put your first line out, and then they started popping and turning, right?
Yeah.
And the sort of product failed, and you guys were really worried, but people actually applauded it, that someone was actually innovating and creating. That must have been a really sort of a good feeling coming out of a bad one at the time.
Well, there were mixed feelings in there, but there were some positives out of a failure,
Yeah. I'm sure part of your message to students, to young entrepreneurs, is that you're going to have to put yourself out there and take the risk to fail, right?
That's right. My favorite expression for the old entrepreneurship teacher at Stanford is, the only time you must not fail is the last time you try.
Ah, there you go. That's a good idiom to live by. And I probably should go back to Stanford. You enjoyed your time there, right? Can Stanford takes a little credit for Nike being what it is, right?
More than a little. That's really where the blueprint began.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Knight. I really, really appreciate you coming on here. This podcast. Before you go, I do have two questions for you. If you could recommend maybe a book for adults, and then maybe a children's book as well.
Oh, golly, you're putting me on the spot here. I don't know, the novel that I just read, which is very unusual, that I think that your readers will like, particularly if they like unusual books, is called 6-4.
6-4, okay.
It's by Hideo Yokoyama. It's a Japanese book which really gives you insight into life there now and bureaucracies, and it was extremely well done, and it's not on everybody's hit list, but it's really quite a good book.
Great, 6-4.
And children's, I don't know.
Maybe you need to write a children's book about Matt and Travis' history and put it out into publication.
Well, I'll give it a lot of thought.
No, well, thank you very much, Mr. Knight. Really appreciate it. Thank you, all the listeners, for listening to this next edition of the Andrew Luck Book Club podcast. See you next time.